The Muslims will fight them, and they will be hiding themselves behind the trees and the rocks. Even the trees and the rocks, they hate the Jews. And the trees and the rocks would say, Ya Abdullah, O servant of Allah, come, there is a Jew behind me, kill him.
وطن غدت برجالها مسيوجة
مسيوجة
لهل العدا سم وطريق اللاوي ولهل الهدى واد وساع فجوجة مرقى براسه والشرف متساوي واسمعهم
This is Radio Jihad.
Global Security Matters.
Good evening. Sorry, I didn't have my microphone switched on. And hi, Kel, in the chat room. Now, it is December the 14th. It is 2012, a very sad day for people in America after what happened in Connecticut. I have actually just posted something on my Facebook page. What Americans do with their gun laws and what's in their constitution is their right. But I'm actually a little bit peeved at people posting pro right to bear arms and ridiculing Britain's gun control laws onto my Facebook page. It's very sad what happened today. It is also sad the way issues like that can become politically exploited. Now, you know, one's heart goes out for the families and, you know, of those children and teachers who were killed. However, there was an incident that happened in Fremont where in California, a man went into a Fremont mosque and then threatened to shoot people. Because of the incident in Connecticut today, the Council for American Islamic Relations has put out a press release. Now, the executive director of the San Francisco Bay Area Office of CARE, a man called Zahra Bilou, or it could be a woman, actually, with a name like Zahra, I'm not sure, Z-A-H-R-A, urged local elected officials to unequivocally condemn bigotry and Islamophobia, saying, "We believe the people of Fremont who appreciate and celebrate the diversity of their city will see this for what it is." This is the incident on Wednesday when a man went in with no gun visible and threatened to shoot members of the mosque. Obviously, what CARE are doing is they are capitalizing on what's gone on today to then bring out their press release. And Bilou said, "It is important to connect the dots between this alleged incident and the constant tide of hate rhetoric and Islamophobia that we are seeing across the country." Fine. What about CARE's support of Hamas? Hamas, a terrorist organization which has killed 300 Israeli civilians and far more Israeli soldiers, and has also tried to create wars, as happened recently. The Council for American Islamic Relations supports CARE. It supported the Holy Land Foundation, which was funneling money to Hamas. Therefore, CARE as an organization really has no moral foot to stand on. The only thing that it can actually say in its favor is that, according to itself, it is the largest Muslim advocacy group. And unfortunately for normal Muslims who don't want to be involved in Islamism and terrorism, it doesn't actually help their case when the leaders of CARE do support terrorism and refuse to have Hamas treated as a terrorist organization, even though it commits terrorist acts and constantly sends missiles whenever it can into Israel. That makes it a terrorist organization. And it is pretty shoddy that today they should be releasing, after the Connecticut shootings, they should be releasing their own little exploitation to draw attention to their story about gun control. When people are looking through media news wires about news to do with the shooting, and they come across a CARE press release in amongst all the others. It is personally sick. It is exactly what CARE does. They did when Rosa Parks, the lady who was on the Birmingham, Alabama bus, who refused to give up her seat and removed to the back of the bus. She was doing her sewing. She didn't want to be interrupted. When she died, now she was a Christian lady who had Alzheimer's. When she died, Nihad Awad, who was then the, or he still is, the chairperson of the Council for American Islamic Relations, he was having a meal, what's called an iftar dinner. When Muslims have Ramadan, their holy month, in the evening after sundown, they break their fast by having a meal. And in the White House under George W. Bush, this was the end of 2005, I believe, November. When Rosa Parks died, on that day, CARE decides to then offer a bursary, a big pot of money to people who can prove that taking Rosa Parks, who was a Christian, you know, not a Muslim, anybody who can prove that they had been helping to stand up for the rights of Muslims could get an award. The award was about $1,000. Considering CARE was founded with money from Saudi Arabia, $1,000 is chicken feed for a bursary. It means nothing. It costs CARE nothing. But it gives them the opportunity to publicly state how they are supporting civil rights. Whereas they never ever, it seems, stand up for the rights of people being oppressed by Muslims in Muslim countries. It's always, if they deal with international stories on their website, it is always about Muslims being victimized, which is fine. Those things should be highlighted. No person should be victimized on account of their beliefs. But CARE is just a political front for Islamism. It's controlled half by Muslim Brotherhood supporters. Hamas itself, whom they have been supporting and channeling money to through the Holy Land Foundation, is a Muslim Brotherhood terrorist group. It is really quite sickening to see the event today being exploited by CARE in their PR. Really, as I said, it's part of a pattern. Now, I want to get away from that subject. Let's go to what's been happening in Germany. In Germany, there was a bomb was found. A bomb was found at a train station. And in Bonn, this isn't the first time there have been bombs in Bonn. Gosh, that sounds so terribly. Bonn, B-O-N-N. And it was actually found on Monday and defused. Not Wednesday. It had four butane gas cartridges, a metal pipe, and inside that there was ammonium nitrate powder, three batteries, and an alarm clock. Now, today, they were suspecting on Wednesday, they put out photographs of a man who he looked like he was either black or very dark. They're now saying, with almost certainty, the prosecutors are saying, the evidence of the man suspected of leaving the bag on the train station platform has links to Islamic radicals. They didn't go further to say exactly which radicals he's connected with, but it was a terrorist bomb which did not go off, and it was the work of Islamists. Whether he was, well, he obviously, if he's part of a group, it was a little blue bag. Then it's very interesting to know which group it actually is. Okay. Right. The ammonium nitrate, by the way, that was, it's a fertilizer. It's been used in several terrorist attacks. It's very commonly used in the southern part of Thailand, in the three states which are being fought over by Islamic terrorists who want those three states to or provinces to secede from Thailand. Most notably, though, Timothy McVeigh used ammonium nitrate on the Alfred P. Murrah building in Oklahoma, which about 150 people were killed. He had a huge amount in a van, but it is potentially very, very explosive. It creates, when ammonium nitrate goes off, it creates oxygen, so it expands at a massive rate. The other bombing substance of choice, which is used, for example, on the when you had in 7th of July 2005, the 7/7 bombings, when you had four individuals with backpacks full of explosives who blew up three trains and one bus, killing 52 people in all, that was using triacetone triperoxide. And in a similar way, this creates oxygen and expands at a rapid fashion. Difference between ammonium nitrate, which produces flame as well, is with triacetone triperoxide, there is no big yellow flash of flame. It is the only flame that you're going to see in one of those bombings is the initial, they generally use another material to with a detonator, which will set it off. That's the only flash that you see. There were two girls from Tennessee who were in one of the tube trains who was, they were bombed, and they were saying that there was, it wasn't like in the movies they were saying, there weren't any flames. That's triacetone triperoxide, made from hydrogen peroxide and other substances, which are easy to get. Ammonium nitrate is also, unfortunately, easy to get because it is used in fertilizers. Similarly, when Anders Behring Breivik set up a bomb in the political quarter of Oslo on July the 22nd, 2010, that was using ammonium nitrate. Just, you know, a little, I don't know, not really much information, and I'm not trying to tell people how to go out and do create their own explosives, but it is sad that these are things that almost anybody could make if they so chose. Now, in London, there was going to be a debate about creationism. It was actually going to be about a dispute about Islam and evolution. And it was going to be put on by a group called the Dean Institute. This is a Muslim debating forum, which apparently, according to the blurb, it says it promotes critical thinking. And it wanted to have a conference titled Have Muslims Misunderstood Evolution at the beginning of next year in a British university, Imperial College. Unfortunately, they were then, every single Islamic society in British universities in London, apparently, went on the rampage and started threatening violence. Now, Adam Dean, a co-founder of the Institute, said, "We eventually had to give up getting any support from student Islamic society because it was simply seen as too controversial." And basically, one of the people who are involved in this made a very interesting comment at the end. There's an American biologist. Now, he's called Ehab Abu Haif. Now, he was planned to be one of the speakers. He's a biologist, and obviously if you're dealing with biology, genetics, etc., you cannot discuss or actually deal with genetics without dealing with hereditary things and evolutionary theory. Now, he said, There's a lot at stake here because it's well beyond evolution. He said, if it's not about the evidence, if you reject science, he's talking about the Muslim protesters, if you reject evolution as a science and you're not willing to listen to evidence, then that means that for all of science, when it comes into contact with sociological, political conflicts, then you won't believe it either. He said, what got me out of my seat, my lab chair, is my want of the Muslim world to become innovators and to share in being leaders in technology and innovation and share in production and not just be consumers. Well, if you look at the amount of Nobel Prizes for science, and I think there's about four individuals who have, since the 1950s, from the Islamic world, who have actually managed to get scientific Nobel Prizes, whereas Israel has had hundreds. And when you think there's only 6 million people in Israel, and one-fifth of the world's population is meant to be Muslim, there is something very seriously wrong with Islamic science. Okay, I don't want to preach. I do that all the time. I've been running around today, so I'm a little bit out of breath, unfortunately. That will go. Some fun news. Now, this is fun. In Indonesia, which is they say it's the largest Muslim country in the world. Well, it has the largest number of Muslims. That is true. It's not a real country. It is the annexation of thousands of islands, about 4,000 islands in all, I think 4,170 or so. It's an archipelago. It has a few big islands like Java and Borneo. And it is in Borneo, one of the, which is not really an island, you know, Borneo is attached to the mainland, I should say, of Asia. But in Borneo, it is an island, sorry, what am I talking about? In Borneo, in Indonesia, a 48-year-old man has been detained along, the story is, he claimed to be an Islamic prophet, and he got his male followers, he convinced them to allow, sorry, I shouldn't snigger, he convinced them to allow him to have sex with their wives and daughters because he was telling them this is all really good for Islam. And he received money as well. It's a nice job if you can get it. I'm sorry to say, I mean, that's really bad. What this says, I mean, I think it's funny. There was another man before, apparently. In 2009, an Indonesian court jailed for blasphemy a cult leader who gave sermons in his underpants and demanded that his acolytes take part in orgies. Well, okay. But this man is... he could be jailed for fraud and blasphemy, but what worries me about this... okay, I think it's funny on the surface. But underneath it, there is something really very sick going on here. It's like, what did the women think? If these men could be persuaded... now, people are saying in the Indonesian press that he used hypnosis on the men to let them give him his wives and daughters to have sex with. But what about the woman's right to choose? Did they have any rights? Did the husband even think that these women could actually say, no, I'm not married to you, I think you're disgusting, piss off? It seems, sadly, not. One of the police officers, a district police spokesman, he was speaking to Agence France-Presse, AFP. He said he didn't know if the women had consented to sex or if the man even had any female followers. Again, it seems like Islam has followers who in certain... I mean, Borneo is not really part of mainstream Indonesia. It is on the edges. Large parts of it are still forest, fortunately, for the you know, for the environment. But this man, he's called Bantil. He was living in East Kalimantan province on the island of Borneo. He was actually arrested 3 or 4 days ago on December the 10th. He says he's an Islamic prophet. Very, very bizarre. Now, I have another news source on this, but it just seems to be much of the same thing. He's in Kutai Timur district. He was called by his followers Sayyed Muhammad. I don't know what, you know, that means. It's obviously a title. He claimed to be a prophet. His teachings deviated from Islamic values. Well, I don't know. Muhammad slept with a lot of people. He persuaded his best friend, Abu Bakr, to give him his 6-year-old daughter, to give him his daughter in marriage. He admitted to having slept with dozens of his followers' wives to cleanse their sins. Police suspect he hypnotized his victims to get whatever he wanted. He's being charged not with blasphemy, but Articles 372 and 378 of Indonesia's Criminal Code with fraud and embezzlement. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if he's got some... God knows, I mean, he may have any diseases and passing them on to these poor women, but there's stories in the Boccaccio's Decameron written in about 1350 in Europe. Jokey stories about priests who promise that if someone gives him his wife, then he will bless him and, you know, absolve sins and... there's one, I mean, one story in the Decameron is actually about a priest who says that he can, in order to make work happen in his farm, he must turn his wife into a donkey, so then he can get more work done. And then, as the issue with the donkey is that he then starts to turn her into a creature by molesting her, and then finally the last thing is that he has to add the tail to the donkey, and that's when the farmer tries to protest, and then the priest tells him that because he didn't let him give the donkey a tail, his wife would never be transformed into a donkey and do work for him. It's a bit like that. It is about somebody who has religious power being able to totally abuse it. And this is, I mean, what's going on here? I mentioned the Decameron because I've been looking at a lot of things about European witchcraft and European heresies, and there are a lot of cases of self-made priests who used to go around exploiting people in their communities. And this seems that when you do have primitive societies with little strict controls, a person who claims to be religious has a lot more power than they could in, say, a big city. I mean, in Bangladesh, there have been priests who have, Islamic priests, who've been able to, you know, imams, who've been able to give out punishments for people who've been raped of 75 lashes. In one case in Bangladesh, there was a woman was stoned to death illegally. It was illegal to stone people to death in Bangladesh. And when one woman decided to write about this, she was chased out of the country. I mean, people were throwing shoes at her. That's Taslima Nazreen. You know, she was a doctor, she was a novelist, and when she first wrote about how this one woman had been stoned to death on the orders of a village imam, she was threatened with violence. She stayed in the country, and then later she wrote a novel called Shame or Laja in the Bangla language, which was about how Hindus had been raped and abused during their war for independence from Pakistan, and she was literally kicked out of the country. Then she went to Calcutta in India, and then she was twice threatened with decapitation by the local head of the largest mosque in Calcutta, now called Kolkata. Absolutely bizarre. And yet, in India, she has also been prosecuted for insulting religion. And yet, the priest, the imam, who ordered that she should have her head cut off, and he did it twice because of things she said that weren't respectful enough of Islam, he has never once been taken up for a court. It is bizarre when you have religions and their leaders who can be virtually above the law. And this is something that is going to get worse, I think, as time goes on. Now, a document was released a few days ago. It was actually officially released a week ago. I have a copy of it in PDF form by the National Intelligence Center, which I think is absolutely bizarre. This National Intelligence Committee, let me just bring it up. I'm going to deal with this after the break. Global Trends 2030, Alternative Worlds, it is called, a publication of the National Intelligence Council. This is a group which is meant to advise the president on policy. What it states, in brief, is it says that by 2030, Islamic jihad will have disappeared entirely, and then there will probably, according to this report, be Christian and Hindu jihadism. I really don't see it. I can see if Islamic terrorism carries on, yeah, there will be backlashes. There will be big backlashes. And I think the Islamic world will be shocked at what will happen if it carries on with its oppression of other religions. But really, the idea of Islamic terrorism is just going to suddenly stop in a mere 18 years' time? I don't think they really have much evidence, but I will be dealing with it. It's 160 pages long. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I am going to try and deal with at least the executive summaries and some of the... they've got a few graphs where they try and make out what's going to happen, but it is really... It doesn't ring true for me. Now, I'm a bit out of breath at that. I've been, as I said, I was running around a lot today, and I do have a lung problem, so I now need to have a little break. I'm going to play for Kel, who is in the chat room. This is especially for her. This is by Gabriel Fauré. This is Berceuse. It's a four-minute piece of music, and I'll be back after this break. This is for you, Kel. Enjoy. Okie doke. Right, I'm back now. Yes, I was having just a little brief look through that Global Trends article from the National Intelligence Committee, and it is all very, very bizarre. I mean, it's dealing with a lot of issues, but it's really trying to sort of blame economics for this. So until I've actually looked through it properly, I'm not going to be able to say too much, but I'm just going to read for you the so-called executive summary. This is basically from the same department as where James Clapper comes from. Apparently it's the fifth installment in their National Intelligence Council series, aimed at providing a framework for thinking about the future. Well, next week when I have my show, it will be December the 21st, 2012, it'll be the end of the Mayan Fourth World. Well, whether we're going to actually be able to get to 2030, according to some people, we're not going to actually even make it to Christmas Day. But let me just get to this executive summary. I mean, there's a lot of blurb at the beginning, which is from Christopher Combe, who's the chairman of the National Intelligence Council. Then it starts to slap itself on the back about previous things. Right. Oh, it's not really much in it. It just says, executive summary. This report is intended to stimulate thinking about the rapid and vast geopolitical changes characterizing the world today and possible global trajectories during the next 15 to 20 years. As with the NIC's previous Global Trends reports, we do not seek to predict the future, which would be an impossible feat, but instead provide a framework for thinking about possible futures and their possible futures and their implications. Other people who've been talking about this in the media have, you know, mentioned, which is probably true, that America's economic growth is going to be eclipsed by China very soon. But the thing is, for all of the people in China to get the wealth of what the people in America have, you would have to multiply the entire global economy. China would have to produce all of that to provide for its millions of civilians. So America still is doing pretty well in the world. But I do not see the one of the mooted scenarios within this is that Islamic Jihad will end in 2030. I think that is one of the most ludicrous theories I have come across. It never has been that way. I mean, Al-Qaeda had a 25-year plan. According to them, by 2030, the whole world, or at least the Muslim countries, which have about 50% Islamic populations, every Muslim country will be part of one unified caliphate, and it will be able to use the United Nations to pressure people, which... That was something that has been reported about since 2005. And it came from a man called Saif Adel, who is one of the people, when they had the death of Osama bin Laden, he was one of the people who was put forward as a candidate to head Al-Qaeda. He's originally from Egypt. Instead, you ended up with the deputy leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, took charge, who apparently is very unpopular within large factions within Al-Qaeda. Now, in Mali, things are getting a lot worse. That's in North Africa. The jihadist state is becoming more repressive. Now, in France, there is a man called Jean-Marie Le Pen. He was always regarded as a racist, and his daughter, Marine Le Pen, she's taken over from him, part of the French National Front, and she's tried the Front National. They are now, apparently, in the city of Lyon, which is in the south of France, they're trying to prosecute his daughter, Marine Le Pen, because she made a speech 2 years ago in which she said that Islamic prayers were similar to the Nazi occupation of France. Now, I think she was talking about the prayers taking place when people were taking over entire streets. There have been laws now which have prevented that. There are no longer the ability of people to take over streets, you know, and say that because we don't have enough space in our mosques, we're going to commandeer streets and wall them off. There are now officials in Lyon are hoping to prosecute her for inciting racial hatred. She said that the presence of Muslim prayer services on the streets of France, a common sight, was due to overcrowding in mosques. She said, "For those who like to talk about World War II, to talk about occupation, we could talk about, for once, the occupation of our territory. This is an occupation of parts of our territory. There are no armoured vehicles, no soldiers, but it is an occupation all the same, and it weighs on people." Well, I mean, she has tried to take her father's rather racist rhetoric and try to make the Front National less against people of different colour. But the thing is, France, in a lot of its ghetto areas, the banlieue, the suburbs, has a very high population of Muslims. And her comments, I don't see anything about that which is inciting racial hatred. Many people were complaining about people taking over streets and praying as if they have a right to stop the thoroughfare from going on. Another story in the news, a woman, age 29, a woman called Rima Begum. Now, she used to be one of the managers of the British Library. And she's only 29. She jumped 80 foot to her death from a very expensive restaurant, which is owned by Terence Conran in London, because, or just after, on Facebook, her people started talking about her Western lifestyles, and then they started exposing to her strict Muslim parents that she was living a life of Western decadence. And apparently she had lost her job. This internet stalker, he got stuff from her Facebook profile to then send information. He sent poison pen letters to her and to her parents. And very sadly, this woman, she went to this restaurant, put down her handbag and the glass she was drinking from with a note underneath it. Then she climbed onto a ledge and then threw herself off. 8 stories she fell. And her family, I'm trying to work out actually where they came from originally. That's not too clear in this article. It's just very tragic. I mean, you know, she had other issues, but it seems that in this letter, she'd said that, you know, she was struggling to reconcile her Muslim faith and her lifestyle. And apparently her parents, I think they were living in Britain, but they were very strict. And apparently because this was part of the factors which led to her committing suicide. It's very sad, really, overall. Okay. Well, there's another story about why is the number of Muslims in the UK risen so much? We've just had information recently about our census from last year has been analysed and now published. But in Australia, there is a man called Alan Jones. Now, this is going back to 2005. He's a broadcaster, and this is not very nice, and it is racist and nasty. He spoke about Lebanese Muslims as being vermin and mongrels, which isn't very nice. It's called Alan Jones, and he has a radio show. every day between 8 a.m. and 8:30. And he has been told by the Administrative Decisions Tribunal that he must apologize any day next week over the comments he made in April 2005. This goes back, the decision to make him, to find him guilty was made in 2009. It was in April 2005 he made his speech. And he had, I'm trying to find the original speech. This is the apology that he's meant, they've told him he must read this out. I mean, this is part of it, I'm not going to read all of it. And this is what he's expected to say. On the 28th of April 2005, on my breakfast program Radio 2GB, I broadcast comments about Lebanese males, including Lebanese Muslims. The comments were made following a Channel 9 TV current affairs show about the conduct of young Lebanese men in Hickson Road at The Rocks. The Administrative Decisions Tribunal has found that my comments incited serious contempt of Lebanese males, including Lebanese Muslims. I want to find out what he actually said. He referred to these men as vermin and mongrels. He said they simply rape, pillage, and murder a nation that's taken them in. Now, this is referring, there have been some pretty awful things going on. There was a man called Mohammed Scaff and his brother Bilal Scaff, who ran a gang in New South Wales, which used to go around taking young white men and forcing them to engage in oral sex. They've both been jailed. They have both been treated as heroes by many Islamists in Australia. There have been several cases of similar aspects. There was a thing called Cronulla Beach, which is a very popular beach. There were gang warfare was going on at the end of 2005 between Lebanese gangs and local gangs. But in the original decision in 2009, the tribunal awarded £10,000 in damages to a person called Mr. Kezar Trad. Now, Kezar Trad, he used to be the spokesman for the so-called Australian Mufti. This is a man called Taj Amin Al-Hilali. Now, Al-Hilali is the person, I don't know if you remember the case a few years back, where he said very famously in his mosque that, again, he was talking about how Muslim men virtually have a right to rape women who aren't covered up. Now, what's the so-called Mufti of Australia, Taj Amin Al-Hilali, had actually said was, if you have meat and you leave it out and you don't cover it, who can blame the cats for coming to eat the meat? He was talking about women who didn't wear burqas. And he was basically saying that if women don't dress modestly, i.e. disguise themselves as tents, then they are entitled, they cannot blame anyone else but themselves for when men rape them. Pretty severe stuff from the person who's meant to be the most important Muslim in Australia. He was the imam of the Lakemba Mosque in a suburb of Sydney. And Kezar Trad, who wasn't working, he was the spokesman for the so-called Mufti, who has about 8 or 9 children living off welfare benefits paid for by the Australian taxpayers. Now, at that time, he was supporting the Mufti when he was talking about meat being left out for cats. And he made a complaint, and he demanded that the presenter made a public apology. Now, I think that what this guy said, this was a bit stupid. It was stupid. It was related to things in the news. But you can't demonize a whole community and say they're all rapists. That is just wrong. But what he'd said, you know, the original statement, he said, if ever there was a clear example that males in their vast numbers not only hate our country and our heritage, this was it. This was then, there was a documentary showing young Lebanese males, or males of Lebanese origin, taunting police at that time. But Kesar Trad, the guy who brought the prosecution against him, he was awarded $10,000. Australian dollars are actually worth more than an American dollar. Trying to make some personal capital out of it. Well, he has actually now had, in this recent ruling, Kesar Trad won't get a penny because he was not personally insulted. He obviously was trying to make a little bit of cash. Egypt, well, Egypt's in a crisis at the moment, obviously with Mohamed Morsi, the leader of Egypt. He is Muslim Brotherhood member. He had recently, last week we were discussing about how he had made a decision that anyone who contradicted, no one was allowed to contradict him. He was to be basically infallible. Well, after my show last Friday, on the Saturday, it was reported that he had backed down from this controversial statement, but there are still clashes. The constitution, the draft constitution, which he was going to release last week, was going to say that Sharia law should be in control. Secularists don't want that. And there have been lots of fighting. People have been killed. Followers of the Muslim Brotherhood have been seen, photographed, beating people up. There's a very nasty photograph of a 78-year-old woman having her face covered by the hand. She was calling for freedom and for democracy. And this Muslim Brotherhood member has just got his hand over her face so she cannot utter a word. People have been beaten up. People have been killed. So it is really, Egypt is in a vile state at the moment. I don't want to talk too much about it because it's still going on. Whatever I say today, next week, it'll be new news. Someone, Drake's Drum, has put a link. London 24, life in jail for a man who bludgeoned his partner to death in front of their daughter when their relationship broke down. Okay, but yeah, it's not very nice at all. It's a horrible story. But unfortunately, again, he's a Muslim who arrived in 2003. For every story of somebody committing a horrible act, there are other people who commit horrible acts. To me, I'm sorry, I can't see that as being... when people do things in the name of their religion or parts of monarchies, then it's something else. We had a case in Cardiff not so long back. Well, it happened a year ago. The woman was found guilty. She had a small child, aged only 7. She was forcing him to memorize the Quran. Because he didn't memorize the Quran, she basically beat her child to death. And she didn't just beat him once, she beat him successively as part of a process to try and get this child to memorize the Quran. The Quran is a... He managed to get one chapter of the Quran memorized. Now, that if I could memorize one chapter of the Quran over a year, which is what she started when he was 6, this poor little boy, they gave him a promise of a bike, and it was only, you know, less than a month ago when she was convicted. I mean, her court case was pretty horrific. You know, those sorts of stories are the stories which you can blame on not just Islam, but peer pressure to look good within Islamic communities. When you get a person who happens to be Muslim who does something horrible, there is a thing called essentializing. And what one does by highlighting stories like that, That's when you open the gates for other people to jump in and use accusations of racism. And unfortunately, this is the very... To do a show like this in Britain, to be the person I am, openly critical of Islam and Islamism, you have to be very careful what you say, because something you may say casually then gets recorded, taken down, and used against you. There's this terrible website called Loon Watch. I've been arguing against members of it recently. And they've, you know, carried stuff about me for a while. I've been vilified by Hope Not Hate, which is another British organisation, which claims that I live in Norway, even though I've never been to Norway in my life, and also says that I'm one of the people who helped to influence Anders Breivik to kill 77 people in Norway. You know, you end up... People, unfortunately, take this bullshit seriously. This report, the counter-jihad report, came out in August 16th last year, just before Anders Behring Breivik went to trial. It was reproduced by the Guardian newspapers. The Telegraph newspaper, which is a very good newspaper, took the report, wrote about it. MSNBC in America took the report, treated it seriously, even though it is crap. It is just trying to exploit a situation, and anybody who's ever said anything critical about Islam then gets blamed for the deaths of 77 young people. This is the society we live in, and that's why I have to be very careful about stories that I legitimize on here by saying this is, you know, bad. I have to really make a difference between essentializing Muslims and taking cases of honor killing and Muslim culture and actually saying these are bad, or terrorism in the name of Islam, that is bad. But I have to be very careful to make sure that I always stress that people are entitled to believe whatever they want to believe in, and that nobody should be prevented from having a belief, even if that belief is, I don't know, devil worship, for example. One should be allowed to have those beliefs, but nobody has the right to push them onto anybody else. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't seem to realize there is a difference. That, I mean, we have so many political Islamists portraying themselves as moderate who are changing aspects of society. Schools, you know, forced to have halal meat and things like that. Now, this is another thing, in Chicago it's starting. Now, the report is actually from the Lebanon. Very good newspaper, the Daily Star, in Lebanon. There is a campaign going on in America, advertising and social media campaign, which is hoping to reclaim the word jihad from extremists who insist on equating the spiritual quest with terrorism. Well, I'm sorry, this is going to be a really uphill battle, and I would love to know who is behind it. It isn't too clear in this article. Now, they're intending... it's as a reaction against the... I'm just going to quote, you know, from what this person said. It said it was sparked by a series of hateful ads calling Muslims savages and urging people to defeat jihad plastered on buses and trains in New York, Chicago, San Francisco. This is one of the Pamela Geller things. Now, I personally think that it's all very well to try now to say that the word jihad just means struggle, but this is like trying to shut the stable door after the horse has bolted. Throughout history, throughout the Crusades, I mean, when Saladin was leading the Third Crusade against Richard the First, you know, the Richard the Lionheart, it was a jihad. When Hassan al-Banna of the Muslim Brotherhood has in the slogan for the Muslim Brotherhood, "Jihad is our way," our way is not a personal struggle with one's conscience. It is jihad, holy war. Jihad as struggle, Mein Kampf means my struggle. I mean, that's another aspect that these people don't seem to realize. Anyway, Let's just look at what the ads say. One of them has an African-American man leaning on the shoulder of a Jewish friend. Oh, how cute. And the slogan is, "My jihad is to build friendships across the aisle." Another ad has got a portrait of a mother with her three remaining children. And she says, "My jihad is to march on despite losing my son." A third poster has two women in headscarves. And they say, "My jihad is not to judge people by their cover." Well, if all you see is the cover, then you don't have much of a choice, do you, darling? Anyway, it sounds like a load of shit to me, but organizers, the ads have already been placed on buses in Chicago. It's led by a group, Ahmed Rehab. Oh, Ahmed Rehab, he's a member of CARE. God, pathetic. Ahmed Rehab, who likes to do bodybuilding, and he had a very gay-looking photograph of himself with purple sunglasses on. Oh, God. He's the executive director of the Chicago branch of the Council on American Islamic Relations, and he really fancies himself. Awful man. He says, "Jihad is a term that has unfortunately been widely misrepresented by the actions of Muslim extremists first." Oh, it's all bollocks, and I'm sorry, you know. CARE, the Council for American Islamic Relations, supports Hamas, which is a terrorist organization. So they can just piss off. I'm not going to even bother with this, apart from they campaign wants to have, they're going to extend, they're trying to get funds. It's already on buses in Chicago. They want to put it on buses and trains in New York, Washington, San Francisco, Seattle, Houston, Dallas, Cleveland, and Oklahoma City. And then they want to get the ads on buses in Toronto, London, Manchester, Sydney, and Melbourne. Well, if they apply to the Saudis, I'm sure they will get support for it. That gets me annoyed. I'm sorry. Now, another story about, I mean, that little poster in there, the idea of the Muslim leaning on the Jewish character, you know, and not crushing him into the ground, saying, "My jihad is to build friendships across the aisle." Well, that ended up creating a lot of problems for a Pasadena church, which thought, in the name of community cohesion, interfaith harmony, that it would open its doors tomorrow, I believe, to allow a group called the Muslim Public Affairs Council to hold its annual convention there tomorrow. Now, the All Saints Church in Pasadena, California, thought that it would be a really good thing, a bold demonstration of progress in interfaith relations. Little did they seem to know, these poor, sad people who, I mean, there is nothing like the road to hell being paved with good intentions. The Muslim Public Affairs Council is again a Muslim Brotherhood front group. The Muslim Brotherhood who, you know, jihad is our way. And jihad, of course, according to the supporters of CARE, which is another Muslim Brotherhood front group, oh, jihad just means our struggle. I mean, how much bullshit and deceit and disingenuous manipulations of the truth can these individuals thrust down our throats and expect us to buy into the bullshit? Excuse my language, but it is bullshit. And it is really quite offensive. And then these poor people at this church, I mean, they really were trying their best, not realizing that for every time there's interfaith work, it is always a Christian church, or, you know, generally a Christian church where they have the interfaith services, but never in a mosque. I mean, we've had it in St. Paul's Cathedral, you know, London's premier cathedral. We have had interfaith services where a Christian person introduces, and then you have a Muslim person preaching about how Allah is the same God and we all worship the same God. Then a Jewish person comes on. But never, ever, ever have any of these interfaith services taken place in a mosque. Why? Why is it always into Christian churches that these interfaith things go on? Now, poor old Reverend J. Edwin Bacon Jr. It's really sad because he meant so well. He said, "I've been called names all my life from the ultra-conservative reactionary position, but this is a level of demeaning that I've not seen before. Demeaning not just of me, but of the Muslim faith, of this organization, the Prophet Muhammad, and the Quran. It tells me that there's a culture of fear in America, a perversion of Christianity, which has turned it into the religion of fear, which it, of course, is not. Well, I'm sorry. When people threaten to kill you and cut your heads off if you dare to insult their prophets, then yes, you're going to create a culture of fear, and Christians tend to be, throughout the Muslim world, it's happened in Egypt, it's happening in Pakistan all the time, it happens in Indonesia, where people get bombed. It is, unfortunately, a sad fact of life that Islamic extremists have made Christians to become worse than second-class citizens. They have become moving targets to be physically attacked, killed and raped, literally. It has been happening in West Africa. The Boko Haram group started off only attacking police stations and the occasional government office. Now actively goes out at Christmas. We're going to have Christmas coming up in a couple, a week and a half's time. Look forward to, like they had in Easter, like they had last Christmas, a campaign of bombings against Christians. That's, you can't blame all of Islam, you can't blame all of Muslims for that. But unfortunately, this sad man, this Reverend J. Edwin Bacon Jr. of the All Saints Episcopal Church in Pasadena, California, when he talks about demeaning of the Prophet Muhammad, well, I'm sorry. A man who has sex with a 9-year-old girl, which is what he did with Aisha, how can you not insult that sort of activity? I mean, if that someone doing that around today would be on Megan's list. You wouldn't approve of it. And I'm sorry, J. Edwin Bacon Jr., you are a useful idiot because you have allowed yourself to be duped by the Muslim Public Affairs Council. The Los Angeles Times, oh my God, how left-wing, stupid, liberal can you get, published an editorial yesterday saying that the church's decision to host the convention was a mitzvah. No, it's not. It would be a mitzvah to host a convention by Muslims who actually wanted to integrate with others. Not Muslims who believe that America should be subservient to Islamic thought and be under Sharia law. That is not a mitzvah. A mitzvah is a good deed. It's a religious obligation. It is something good. It is not lying down and allowing people who support terrorism, which is what the Muslim Brotherhood does. Let's not forget what the Muslim Brotherhood through Hamas has done. Let's not forget in 1948 the bombings and the shootings within Israel of Jewish and Christian shops and businesses and individuals, who ran these businesses who were Jewish and Christian, by the Muslim Brotherhood, by its special operations wing. This is total bollocks. I mean, I'm sorry. Of all the groups, it's like, Little Red Riding Hood inviting the wolf in to come and party in her living room. So, I'm sorry if J. Edwin Baker Jr. thinks that he's been called names all his life, but not to that level. Well, you deserve it. I'm sorry for being an idiot, and hopefully you will grow up and see the truth. Maybe, maybe not. Still, I've come to just over the half-hour mark, I'm now time for some music. Kel has still there, right? Let's see if I can find some music. This is This is La Mer, a bit of French stuff again. Charles Trenet, his song, written in the 1940s. The ocean or the sea, La Mer.
La mer qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs a des reflets d'argent. La mer, des reflets changeants sous la pluie. La mer au ciel d'été confond ses blancs moutons avec les anges si purs. La mer, bergère d'azur infinie. Voyez près des étangs ces grands roseaux mouillés. Voyez ces oiseaux blancs et ces maisons rouillées. La mer les a bercés le long des golfes clairs et d'une chanson d'amour. La mer a bercé mon cœur pour la vie. La mer qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs a des reflets d'argent. La mer des reflets changeants sous la pluie. La mer au ciel d'été confond ses blancs moutons avec les anges si purs. La mer, bergère d'azur infinie. Voyez, près des étangs, des grands roseaux mouillés. Voyez, les oiseaux blancs et ces maisons rouillées. La mer les a bercés le long des golfes clairs et d'une chanson d'amour. La mer a bercé mon cœur pour la vie.
Okay, in Syria, Bashar al-Assad has started firing Scud missiles based on Soviet technology from the 1950s. Highly inaccurate, apparently. They're difficult to fire, but they carry substantial high-explosive warheads. When they do manage to hit the right targets, they can do massive damage. It seems that, you know, even Russia has said that they believe that Assad, you know, they've been supporting Bashar al-Assad. They're saying that it's very, very unlikely that he's going to come through. Another thing, actually, in the news today, in Britain particularly, there was the case of Alexander Litvinenko. He was a Russian individual who was poisoned with polonium-210, which is an isotope of polonium, radioactive material, and, you know, radioactive elements, or an isotope of it, which means it's got a different amount of electrons in its electron shell than a normal actual polonium itself, the stable form of it. Now, in its radioactive form, polonium-210 was administered to him in tea. News coming out, he was a member of MI6. he was also working for the Spanish. We didn't know that before. He became a Muslim before he died as well, but he had been poisoned by the Russians. And believe it or not, you know, strangely enough, even though this has all been reported now in the media, I'm just arguing with somebody on Facebook at the same time. The Russians have not made any comment, which is quite bizarre. Before, when Britain was trying to get an extradition of the person who they believed was responsible for the murdering of this agent, the Russians were refusing to actually comply. They wouldn't send the guy back, you know, to face trial over here. But the inquest is coming out with some very interesting information. I just think it's, you know, really quite bizarre that, they're actually now even revealing that he's a member of MI6. In Britain, just to clarify, we have MI5 and MI6. MI5 deals with homeland security within Britain's shores. MI6 deals with subversive or spying activities in other countries. Okay, now that's that. Now, Abu Hamza, it was about, I mean, it's coming up at least 3 months now since he was sent back. Abu Hamza, the hook-handed imam, the person who took over in 1997 the Finsbury Park Mosque, he was wanted in America for two things. He was wanted for trying to set up a terrorist training camp at Dog Cry Ranch near Bly in Oregon, and also for his involvement in the kidnapping of 16 tourists in Yemen. He had bought a satellite phone, and there was recordings which the Americans are going to use against him for his trial for that. And his satellite phone, he was recorded speaking to the leader of the kidnap group. These were 16 tourists of various nationalities. And the Yemeni authorities tried to release them. What happened was there was a shootout, and four of these innocent hostages became killed. And Abu Hamza made out to his followers. Now, he came into Britain, he married a woman to get himself citizenship, even though she was still legally married to somebody else. She hadn't divorced her first husband, she married him anyway. But so he really wasn't even, he'd come from Egypt, he wasn't even a legal citizen. Now, he claimed in 1997 he had come back from being abroad, and he had gone away with two hands and two eyes, and he came back with no hands, a pair of hooks, and only one eye that worked. And he made out that he had been in Bosnia. He had been helping the Bosnian people by clearing landmines. Very noble, very worthy. Turns out, actually, how he got to lose his hands was he was in the Dhiranta training camp on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and he was having an explosives lesson, and he mixed up his explosives, and he did it wrong. They started to bubble and smoke. Instead of putting them into a sink and, you know, putting water under them, he ran out with this bowl of bubbling material in his hands. As soon as he got out of the door, the material blew up and took off both his hands and took out one of his eyes. Now, I have absolutely no time for people like him. He was a vile individual. I used to get the 106 bus when I was going home on a Friday evening from Stoke Newington to Finsbury Park, and it would always go past, when it reached Finsbury Park, it would go past the mosque. Now, he used to have, near there, he used to have, on a very quiet street, he used to have sermons and worshippings going on in the street. But in 1998, 1999, up to 2000, the 106 bus route had to be diverted because right next to Finsbury Park Station, he used to have one entire street blocked off, policemen standing by watching, even though it was an illegal activity, they should have arrested them, they didn't, which is another problem why we have such a problem in Britain with jihadists running amok, is that nobody seems to want to prosecute them. When we had all the calls in 1989 for the death of Salman Rushdie, incitement to murder is a crime. Various people, including vile little Cat Stevens or Yusuf Islam, was calling for the death of Salman Rushdie. And a year later, the Director of Public Prosecutions had not prosecuted a single person. The head of Bradford Mosques, Council of Mosques, or the secretary, had said not only would he want to kill Salman Rushdie himself, he was going to encourage his children to do it if he wasn't able to. And yet, with all these calls for murder, not a single person got prosecuted. This was the climate that Britain has created. And that's why Britain, as Daniel Pipes said in January 2007, Britain has been responsible for terrorist attacks abroad in at least 16 countries. He actually was, I mean, it's actually 18 at that time. You know, he missed out a couple. He missed out India and another country. But the thing is, this is something that has been going on in Britain. And Abu Hamza, real name Mustafa, Mustafa al-Masri, that was his real name. But Abu Hamza was blatantly breaking the law. He had young thugs going up and down the sidewalk, threatening people, you know, if they were going to try and intervene or say anything, acting in a very intimidating fashion, while police just stood by and did nothing. And even a bus route had to be diverted to go around, to go down a different street. It was bizarre. But he told everybody that he had been a hero, and he hadn't. Now, he was finally, after years of fighting extradition, taken back to America in about September, and he was trying to get his hooked hands were regarded as a problem because they could be offensive weapons. Now, this is not very nice, but it's true. When he was in Belmarsh Jail in Britain, he's also got a very bad skin condition as well, so he has to have cream rubbed onto it. If you haven't got hands, you have to have some sort of prosthetic device, you know, like it's, you know, his hooked hands. Even those were not good enough, because apparently, according to one journalist, he used to have two assistants just to go for a wee. He would have one assistant would hold back his cloak, while the other one would have to hold his whatever and point it in the right direction. And when he was in Belmarsh Jail, he was arrested and, you know, jailed in 2003 briefly. He was let out again. He was then remanded in custody, and on February the 7th, 2006, he was convicted of soliciting to murder, finally, after years of not having this. And this poor prison officer, a man called Harry, had the very unfortunate job of every time Abu Hamza relieved his bowels, this poor prison officer, who got the nickname Dirty Harry, had to go in and do the business himself. Now, apparently, he is still in America. He was sent back in September. He is still waiting for his new little hands. It's very sad. One wonders how he's actually managing, but they don't go into details. He's 54 years old, but he has been arguing he wants these new devices. When he stood trial, he refused to have, if he couldn't have... he was offered plastic hands, which are just cosmetic. They look like hands. They don't have any grip. They can't open and close. He made a point of refusing to wear those when he was facing court. He'll go to trial in August next year, so we still have 8 months or so to wait. But for over 3 months, he has not been able to have any hands. Now, there is a councillor in Leicester who has, he sent out a, he is quite racist. He belonged to the British National Party, which is a racist group, political group. It has two members in the European Parliament, but it is really quite unpleasant as an organisation. He sent out a leaflet, apparently, which was the council, Leicestershire County Council Standards Committee, said it was really bad. It undermined race relations because he was criticising Muslims or Islam. And they told him that he had to go and do some sensitivity training. And he refused. And what they're now finding is they have absolutely no power, which is interesting. I don't support him because I think, you know, if you... there's a difference between criticising a religion and then attacking the people who follow it. You know, if they've been brought up that way, they probably don't know much better. And I think that, you know, he doesn't sound like it's particularly nice. Now, it's Hanukkah at the moment. And in Israel, on the Temple Mount, Muslims have been rioting. And Jews are now, for the period of Hanukkah, they have been banned from going onto the Temple Mount. Now, Israel National News, Aretz Shiva, you know, Channel 7 News, they're not going to be allowed onto the Temple Mount until Sunday, the last day of Hanukkah. Now, according to Jewish tradition, it's the holiest site on the planet. But for Muslims, Muhammad left Earth and went to heaven on a flying, talking horse called Al-Barak, and went to heaven from Jerusalem, even though he had never set foot in Jerusalem during the entire length of his life. Never, ever. But he had a dream that he would go up to heaven. And because of his dream, I dreamt I was on a Greek holiday yesterday, this morning it was, you know. I mean, yes, so I've been to Greece by Muhammad's logic. But he had a dream, and he went to heaven, and he was offered a glass of milk and various things. And then when he told his followers, I had a dream, and I went to Jerusalem, and there was a mosque there. There were no mosques in Jerusalem, but he was talking of the temple, you know, the Israeli, you know, the Jewish temple. And he set off for heaven on the back of a talking horse, a bit like Mr. Ed, really, but with wings. And it took him up to heaven. Amazing. Great. But even though he had never set foot in Jerusalem, that is why Jerusalem is the most holy place for Muslims, because Muhammad had a bloody dream. Pathetic. But still, they have the Temple Mount, the Dome of the Rock and stuff is all built up there. But according to the story from Aretz Shiva, now, the ban is aimed at preventing a Muslim riot at the site. Riots are thought to be particularly likely following Friday prayers. I mean, Juma prayers, Friday evening prayers, they're gone now. Those are the most important part of the Muslim week. There have been riots and terror attacks in Judea and Samaria. Tensions very high. Soldiers shot Arab attackers in Hebron in two incidents. And Jewish organizations dedicated to Temple Mount activism expressed upset at the police ban. One of them said, the police treat the Temple Mount like a Muslim site and open it to others only when necessary for tourism at times and on days that suit tourists. In comparison, Jewish residents of Israel are discriminated against. And they were calling for the Temple Mount to be open to Jews on every Jewish holiday. Activists have said the police must consider the many who wish to ascend the mount for prayers and visits on Jewish holidays and to institute the model used in the Tomb of the Patriarchs. That's in Hebron, and there's a time shift there. So you have, you know, Jews are allowed to visit it sometime on their holy days, and Muslims on other ones, and it's opened in its entirety to each religion on the holiday days. So this is quite sad, really. You know, and anybody going up who's Jewish onto the Temple Mount to pray, they've been arrested, and it's creating a lot of problems. Now, in Libya, Saif al-Islam al-Gaddafi, he was the son of Gaddafi, who was tipped to succeed him. Now, other sons of Gaddafi were killed, but Saif al-Islam was captured, and he is still alive. In October, he made a request to the International Criminal Court in The Hague, saying that he's been indicted by the ICC for crimes against humanity during the pro-democracy uprisings. But, you know, he's been saying that he's not being treated very well. And the ICC have asked for concrete, tangible, and pertinent, I'm quoting, concrete, tangible, and pertinent evidence to demonstrate to this chamber that proper investigations are currently going on and concrete preparations for the trial are ongoing. You know, I mean, he, in October, had written to the ICC saying, you know, he wanted to go ahead with the trial because obviously he's not being kept in very good conditions in Libya. This is a man who threw his girlfriend off a balcony because she'd not done the right things for him, and he frequently used to beat her about. He is the man who went to the London School of Economics, got a degree, even though he was totally hopeless. But because his daddy's money was being used to fund the London School of Economics, Saif al-Islam al-Gaddafi, I should say, ended up with a first-class degree. And as a result of that and the corruption, the head of the London School of Economics had to resign. So that's one little story. Now today, there is going to be... Oh, yeah. Before I talk about, in Belgium, the release of a new film, which is going to criticize Islam. In India, 89 videos of the other movie, The Innocence of Muslims, which I've only seen the 12-minute extract trailers. It looks dire, but it's led to convictions. 8 people connected with the making of the movie have been given death sentences, not death threats, death sentences by an Egyptian court already, even though I don't know how Egypt claims to have any jurisdiction to people living in America, but it does apparently believe that it has. And 89 copies of this video have been found in India, in Mumbai, in fact, and a team of 16 police personnel worked for 69 days and blocked these 89 videos from being shown. Wow, real waste of police resources, especially when the movie, from all that I've seen, is absolute crap. Now, yeah, back to this thing about this global jihad over by 2030, and then the Christian and Hindu terrorism will come after it. All right, let's just go to a resume. This is the National Intelligence Council. Now, the NIC is offering, I'm just quoting now from the Examiner, it says, the NIC is offering up as proof of their assertion of the pending end of global jihad, is that other terror movements have fizzled out in recent history. Well, you know, okay. This is from a quote from the actual report. Several circumstances, it states, are ending the current Islamist phase of terrorism, which suggests that, as with other terrorist waves, the anarchists in the 1980s, I mean, because President McKinley was shot by an anarchist, in the 1890s, the post-war anti-colonial terrorist movements, the New Left in the 1970s, and the religious recent religious wave. It's receding, and it could end by 2030. Absolute nonsense. Anarchists came and went. I mean, they say about anarchists in the 1880s. Tsar Nicholas II, his father was, Tsar Alexander was, blown up by an anarchist bomb that was actually thrown by the brother of Lenin. But anarchy, and there were several killings. I mean, in Europe, various people ended up getting killed. I think there was a king called Maximilian was killed by anarchists as well. But these little movements, they are very much part of their time and their place. Islamic terrorism, killing of people who blaspheme, killing of people who don't give in, making war on people, enslaving others, this has been going on since 632 AD when Muhammad died. The expansion of Islam has happened through what we could call acts of terrorism. And the Arab Spring, what they're saying in this report, the NIC report, is the Arab uprisings have demonstrated the moral and strategic legitimacy of non-violent struggle. Protesters acted in the name of democratic values, not in the name of religion. Okay, well, that's exactly what Hitler used. He used democratic means to become the Chancellor, then burned down the Reichstag, and then imposed Nazism. And this is what is happening in the Arab Spring Arab countries. Egypt, the country which was the most dramatic example of what the Arab Spring can do, has done exactly that. It has used democracy to put a tyrant in power who has then said, I'm omnipotent, I'm infallible, and we're going to have my way. That is exactly the same. That is not democracy. That is using democracy to impose authoritarian totalitarianism. Right. I don't really want to go into that too much. That report just seems to be absolute hogwash. I mean, anybody can look into an imaginary crystal ball and make statements about the future, but we don't really know. And I certainly do not believe that by 2030 Islamic terrorism is going to stop. It brings results. This is what, when Salman Rushdie, the incident in 1989 with the fatwa by Ayatollah Khomeini on the 14th of February 1989, when that happened, it created results. Muslims who had previously been shopkeepers and quiet and getting on with their lives suddenly realized they had political power because of it. And they were being allowed to call for deaths of Salman Rushdie, were getting away with it. And then from then on, you had the translator, the Japanese translator was stabbed to death, the Italian translator of the Satanic Verses was stabbed, survived. But the thing is, with these killing and terrorist activities, every time you kill one person, more than 100 will be quiet, or far more than that. You just need a few high-profile killings, targeted assassinations, and then everybody is too scared to say anything. You had in the Netherlands, first you had Pim Fortuyn, the leader of the Fortuyn Party, killed by a person who said he was doing it for the Muslims because he had talked about how, there were too many Muslims in the country and the country was losing its Dutch identity. And then on November the 2nd, 2004, you had Theo van Gogh, a descendant of the Vincent van Gogh, the artist, his elder brother, his brother Theo, same name. His descendant, Theo van Gogh, the filmmaker, because he had done a movie with Ian Hersey Ali called Submission, where you had images of texts from the Quran projected onto naked flesh of women. It was a documentary about how women are treated as second-class citizens within Islam. He was going to work on his bicycle on the 2nd of November 2004, and then you had Mohamed Bouyeri, a Moroccan member of a jihadist group, came across him while he was riding his bicycle in broad daylight in the morning, shot him. He fell off his bike, and then he attacked him with a knife, tried to cut off his head, and then stabbed into his chest a knife, and through the knife there was pinned a list of other people who were to be killed. Once you do things like that, other people are too scared to criticize. Until eventually people get to a point where they think, sod it, I'm fed up with being told, shut up, no, don't you dare criticize Islam, don't you dare insult the Prophet. The fact that he was a child molesting warmonger who in one day had 700 Jewish men slaughtered, decapitated, their wives and their children given away as slaves, the fact that he was a genocidal maniac and he was a child molester, no, you can't insult him. You might get killed. It works, but after a period, people say, enough is enough. You cannot live your whole life in fear. That's why I try to be open. I know that I've had, you know, a few people don't like what I'm doing. But the thing is, I try not to attack Muslims, you know, in my speeches or whatever. But Islam as an ideology, it should be criticized. Everybody can criticize Christianity or other religions. Why is Islam off limits? It's off limits because terrorism has been used and people have given in. They have acquiesced to being tyrannized. I've only got a few, I've only got 20 minutes left or so to rant. Sad incident, I don't approve of this at all. A mosque in Berkshire, a 21-year-old man has left a pig's head outside a mosque on October the 23rd. He's been charged with racially aggravated harassment. There is a website called Loon Watch, which is making much about how a cross, a wooden cross with bits of bacon wrapped around it, was left outside a Muslim family home. This is a nasty activity, but Loon Watch has made a lot out of it. It's in Britain, where it happened. Turns out it was a 13-year-old boy. You know, these little incidents get magnified, and yet the intimidation of non-Muslims by Muslims around the world is not discussed by these people who have their media outlets, like CARE does with its press reports, always talking about how Muslims are victimized. And any victimization of anybody for a belief is wrong. But when you lie and you just always point the lens in the wrong direction, there is something much worse, much more morally wrong in that. I'm just gone over 40 minutes, so it's time for another, you know, my last 40 minutes. I've got 20 minutes left. I'm going to play for Reese. I'm going to play something a little bit smutty, if I can find it. She likes... Reese is my co-host. If you want to call in, and I've been very naughty, I haven't given out the number. If you want to call in and chat, we've got 20 minutes left. My number, it's a New York number that you can call into. It's 347-857-1380. We've got 20 minutes left, and we can carry on chatting. Now, this is slightly smutty, but it's for my special Reese. She's the woman who will answer the phone if you ring it.
If I can't sell it, keep sitting on it before I give it away. You've got to buy it, don't care how much you want it. I mean just what I say. Just feel that nice of bottom bit for wear or tear. I really hate to part with such a lovely chair. If I can't sell it, keep sitting on it before I give it away. If I can't sell it, I'll keep sitting on it before I give it away. You've got to buy it, don't care how much you want it. I mean just what I say. When you want something good, you've got to spin your jack. I guarantee you will never want your money back. If I can't sell it, I'll keep sitting on it before I give it away. something good you've got to spend your day. I guarantee you will never want your money back. If I can't sell it, I'll keep sitting on it before I give it away. Oh, Daddy, yes, before I give it away.
Okay, now I have to give my plugs now. The first plug is for the wonderful Rabbi Ariel Nachman Ben Chaim and his online synagogue, the House of Seven Beggars. And that this evening, as soon as this show ends, it will start broadcasting 7 p.m. Central Time, I believe that is. And that'll be 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And the House of Seven Beggars Synagogue, he has online services, and they can be seen on live stream. Now, I don't have a link for them at the present time. Look it up on the internet. He's definitely worth a listen. What he does, he takes biblical stories. Now, I'm not particularly religious, you know. I'm a failed Buddhist, in fact. Failed Christian, failed Buddhist, and now sort of wandering in the wilderness of agnosticism. But what he does is he makes his knowledge of the Talmud and interpreters of Jewish texts throughout history, he makes sense of things from the Tanakh, from the Old Testament. Absolutely amazing guy, lovely personality, great fun, good sense of humour, wonderful guy. If you can, give him a listen to. My second plug is for wonderful honey from Muddy Acres Honey, based in Broadway, Virginia. Now, I've had this imported to Britain because it's so good. And they can be called. James and Crystal Epley have got a farm. They have wild honey from wildflowers around them. And it is absolutely excellent. Really rich, great tasting stuff. And they're also now doing infusions with lavender and jalapeno into their honey. Absolutely wonderful stuff. They can be called at Broadway, Virginia, James and Crystal Epley of Muddy Acres. Their number is, an American number, is 540-896-8938. Check them out. They do wonderful honey, and they will post it to you. Okay, now, having... let's go back to the... I've still got loads more bits of news, but I wanted to go to the end of my news list because there is a man who, in Belgium, they have now got this problem. Last week I mentioned that they had taken their terror alert from between, I think it was from out of a scale of 5, it had gone from 2 up to 4. Because of a man called Imran Firasat. He's an ex-Muslim, and he's made a documentary. And the documentary is called The Innocent Prophet, Life of Muhammad from the Point of View of an Ex-Muslim. Now, what is interesting is International Business Times, which is a British website, it has got an article with an interview by him, and it's got a picture of a cartoon of Prophet Muhammad, which is good. I think it's about time we had more cartoons of Muhammad. The rest of the world's religions have had to cope with being satirized. And the only way to stop terrorism and threats and fear is to desensitize people. If there were, everybody saw cartoons. This is something that Trey Parker and Matt Stone, who were the founders of South Park, they were saying that at the time when the Muhammad cartoon issue happened in Denmark, they were originally published in September the 30th, 2005, and then after the actions of a couple of very hostile Islamists who went round to Al-Azhar University and other places in the Middle East, including going to Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who was then the spiritual leader. He wasn't the official leader, but he was regarded as a spiritual mentor to the Muslim Brotherhood. And then fatwa started coming out. There were death sentences, death threats against the cartoonists who had drawn pictures of Muhammad in the Danish newspaper called Jyllands-Posten. Now, according to Trey Stone, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, if everybody had published the cartoons, there wouldn't have been the targets for the Islamists to sort of home in on, because everybody would have been potentially a target. It would have made ridiculous, you know, their threats. Unfortunately, now you still got people, Molly Norris from Seattle, the cartoonist, she was, a couple of years ago, had to go into hiding. She's still in hiding. She cannot work openly under her own name because of death threats, because she had said there should be an Everybody Draw Muhammad Day. She was only being making a facetious point, but it is an important point. Anyway, this man, he was born in Pakistan. He's living in Spain at the moment, but the tragedy is he is under threat of deportation. Now, he, in Belgium, where they're going to release this movie, it's been released today, apparently, he's given this interview. And I just want to just briefly, because we haven't got more than 10 minutes left, he's being asked, what is your intention behind this this movie? And he says, my sole intention is to reveal the other side of reality of Muhammad's character, which I think is true. In my opinion, Islam was created by Muhammad in order to gain his own objectives, and now it is the time to come out of that illusion. Now, then he's asked, is the movie based on facts, or does it include elements of drama? And he says, this is Imran Firasat, the maker of the movie. He said, the movie is based on real facts, but there is also a kind of Bollywood drama to make it attractive. I don't want people to feel bored and shut down their computers after 10 minutes. I want them to cling to it until the movie ends. But the movie is completely based on true facts. No lie has been used. Now, then he's asked, are you sure these facts are irrefutable? Did any Islamic scholar help you? And he answers, and this is the interesting bit. I'm just going to quote this one response. It's a long one, but I want you to hear it. This is what he said. He said, why do we have the misconception that only Islamic scholars can teach us correct things about Islam? They're not born with the Islamic knowledge, and they learn it in their practical life like any other Muslim. It is important to mention that I have been a Muslim for 26 years and was part of the Islamic society and system for the same duration. That is why I do not need to confirm the facts with any scholar. All the facts are in the Quran, Hadiths, and several historical books. I just present those same facts through a different point of view. Islamic scholars will never admit what is wrong about Islam. They always try to cover up the dubious character of Muhammad. Here are some of the facts I have mentioned in my movie. Muhammad married a 6-year-old girl. Muhammad had 11 wives, despite the fact that Islam allows a maximum of 4 marriages. Muhammad initiated several wars. Muhammad ordered to hate infidels. Muhammad left women suffering and discriminated against for their whole life through his own laws, which appear in the Quran. That is why I know the truth of Islam. I didn't have to contact an Islamic scholar. My own knowledge and experience of 26 years of being a Muslim was sufficient for expressing my point of view on Muhammad's life and character. Now, Terry Jones, who is from Florida, the preacher of the Dove Outreach Project, the one who famously burned a Quran, which led to 8 people being killed in Afghanistan. I mean, they were killed by Muslims who, or Islamists who themselves should be held not responsible, not him. But Now, he apparently had helped with this project, and the other people are involved in it. But this guy, Imran Firas, is very brave indeed. He's got his photograph there. He's being open. That's his real name. He's fighting a real court case to sort of stop himself from being deported back to Pakistan by people in the West, probably pressured by Islamists who are trying to get him out of Europe. It's a real shame that people like him are rare, because the fear, I mean, it's right back from the very beginning of Islam, injunctions to kill people who insult the Prophet. And I really think that sooner or later, people must stand up and say, no, I will not be intimidated. You know, maybe I'm an idiot, you know, doing that now. But I think people should not be bullied. They should not be intimidated into silence. Now, I've got to get offline because it's we're now coming up to 5 minutes to the end of the show. I'm actually going to close the show early because many people have had to go off to go and do other things. And so I want to thank people who've been listening and the people who listen on the recording. I'm going to play one more piece of music and then I'm going to close down the show. Now, that's if I can find it. This is for Reese Cup again. And those of you who are listening in the chat room or listening in the recording, I hope you have a very, very good time. I will be back next week on the 21st, which will be the date of the end of the Mayan calendar. And maybe, you never know, during the middle of the show, we could end up just seeing the end of the world around our ears. It will be the solstice. And I finally found the song for Reese Cup. So thank you very much. Please listen again next week. Global Security Matters on the Blog Talk Radio, Radio Jihad Network. 6 o'clock Eastern Time, Friday night on the 21st of December, a week from today. Okay, this is for Reese. Enjoy.
Did you ever hear the story about the bumblebee who gave a cocktail party for his family? And when he got as high as he could be, he invaded a nudist colony. Buzz, 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 oh my, oh me. Buzz, 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 oh golly gee. Buzz, 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 oh what a spree. When the bumblebee invaded the nudist colony. Now Sister Jenny, wearing just her birthday suit, was strutting around the colony acting like she was cute. She plainly thought she was just about it until that bumblebee stung her on a big fat buzz, 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 oh my, oh me. Buzz, 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 oh golly gee. Buzz, 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 it was an awful spree when the bumblebee invaded the nudist colony. Mama Daisy, acting like a baby girl, naked is the first day she came in the world. She was walking around acting like a nut until that bumblebee stung her on a big fat buzz, 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 oh my, oh me. Buzz, 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 oh golly gee. Buzz, 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 it was an awful spree when the bumblebee invaded the nudist colony. Now Big Fat Bill was naked as he could be. He was happy to be living in the colony. Old Bill got tired and laid down in the grass. Then the bee came along and stung him on his big fat buzz, 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 oh my, oh me. Buzz, 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 oh golly gee. Buzz, 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 it was an awful spree. free. Oh, when the bumblebees faded the nudist colony.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to get offline now. I've got a call going to be coming in a few minutes from Australia, which I have to deal with. But thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Rusey Cup. You're an absolute darling. And hopefully we will talk again next week. May your God go with you. Good night.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then, taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.